Turn then, please, to Genesis chapter 3, verses 16 to 19. And let me just remind you where we are at. The fruit of the divinely forbidden tree has been eaten. God has arrived in the garden where this has just happened, and so far he has been very restrained in his approach to the fruit eaters, Adam and Eve, just asking them questions and saying nothing more to them than that. He has, however, pronounced judgment on Satan. We thought about that last time, and now in this evening's passage, he does finally pronounce judgment on Adam and Eve, or more precisely, on Eve and Adam. It's that way round. And I just want to ask a simple question over the next few minutes, which is this. How severe is his judgment on Eve and Adam? How severe is it? And I want to answer that question in two ways. I want to suggest that we mustn't overestimate the severity of the judgment, and then I want to suggest, and you've probably guessed it already, that we mustn't underestimate the severity of the judgment. And so first of all then, we mustn't overestimate the severity of the judgment. Look at the first half of verse 16, and you can read the first half of verse 16 emphasizing the double occurrence of the word pain, as well as the presence of that other word, multiply. And emphasizing those ominous words, you can then call to mind the shrieks and the groans that you hear if you go anywhere near a maternity ward, whether at the RVI or Cramlington or wherever it may be. And emphasizing those words and calling to mind those shrieks and groans, you can treat what we have here then as terribly bleak, a truly crushing judgment from the hand of God. Alternatively, however, you can come at this from a different angle, and you can read the first half of verse 16, emphasizing instead those last five words, you shall bring forth children. You shall bring forth children. Now, that alternative way of reading it may cause one or two of you to snort cynically. That's all very well for you, Dan, to put a positive spin on the verse, downplaying the pain. You're a man. You've never been in labor. You've never suffered the agonies of giving birth. You might not have such a sunny take on the whole thing if you were a mother who's been there and done it. And I get that, and it's absolutely true, of course. I've no personal experience of giving birth. But I think it is worth pointing out that when it comes to downplaying the pain of childbirth, the Bible itself is not above doing that. I mean, you think of a passage like Psalm 127, to which Robert took us on Wednesday evening, and it simply celebrates the arrival of children, doesn't it? The psalm is wholly positive about the experience. There's not the slightest hint in it that bringing forth children is now post-Eden a mixed blessing, that there's now a dark side to childbearing because of the divine judgment that's attached to it. Or more pertinently still, you think of Jesus' words in John 16. This is John 16, verse 21. He says, when a woman is giving birth, she has sorrow because her hour has come. But when she has delivered the baby, she no longer remembers the anguish for joy that a human being has been born into the world. In other words, what we have in our text here in Genesis is God incorporating into childbirth a short, sharp experience of pain that's immediately swallowed up in a surge of overwhelming maternal joy. That's not my construal of the situation. That's Jesus' construal of the situation. Jesus would agree that the reading of the verse that emphasizes, instead of the word pain, the words you shall bring forth children, is a legitimate and a viable reading. Indeed, look at the second half of verse 16. And it's usually assumed that God is there saying something quite grim, and that he's adding then some kind of further judgment, that it's a bad thing that's being described there in the second half of verse 16. I don't think that's correct. I think God is, in fact, in the second half of verse 16, mitigating the judgment that he has just pronounced. You see, the issue is this. The pain involved in childbearing could prove a major deterrent. Women could just decide that marriage and sex is a mug's game if it's going to result in this, in writhing and screaming trying to get a baby out of your body. They could just decide that they'll give all of that a miss. But the second half of verse 16, you see, is indicating that God is not going to let that happen. He's going to ensure that women don't go down that route, that despite the prospect of painful childbirth, there will be marriage. He shall rule over you, which doesn't here denote something sinister, some sort of repressive rule, some sort of tyrannical rule. It simply means you will enter that covenant relationship with a man whereby he exercises headship over you. Despite the prospect of painful childbearing, there will be marriage still. And despite the prospect of painful childbearing, there will be sexual relations. Your desire shall be for your husband. Sexual attraction will get the better of any fear of pregnancy, in other words. And so you get, I hope, the mitigating nature of those two lines there at the end of verse 16. The point is, God is not going to allow the pain of childbirth to imperil the future of the human race. Let's move on now to verses 17 to 19. And the judgment there pronounced on Adam. And you can read these verses too then, in a very negative way, emphasizing the word cursed in the middle of verse 17, and the word pain again at the end of verse 17, and the reference to thorns and thistles in verse 18, and the reference to the sweat of your face in verse 19. And emphasizing those doer words, you can then recall experiences that you've had trying to grow fruit and veg in your garden and the way in which you've had to give up because it was all such hard work. Catherine's not here to contradict that point. And emphasizing those words then and recalling those gardening experiences that you've had, you can treat what we have here as a really devastating divine judgment. But, as with verse 16, there's an alternative angle to that. You can read verses 17 to 19, emphasizing instead those three words that occur three times, you shall eat. The phrase is there in verse 17, it's there in verse 18, it's there in verse 19, you shall eat. And again, if you're cynically disposed, you can have a go at me for suggesting that alternative angle. Well, it's easy for you, Dan, to take a rosy view of these verses, downplaying the exertion involved in producing food. You're not a farmer. You're not living on a croft in the Scottish Highlands a century or two ago, battling against harsh winters and infertile soil, trying desperately each day to keep the wolf from the door. Experiencing that kind of lifestyle for a while would stop you reading these verses so cheerily. And again, I get that. I mean, I conveniently purchase my food from the supermarket where there's lovely aircon cooling the place and the most strenuous action is just kind of, you know, reaching out to a shelf and you don't come away with any sweat on your face. But as before, it's interesting to reflect that the Bible itself is quite capable of downplaying the exertion of producing food. You think of Psalm 104 that we sang a few minutes ago. One of the verses we sang was verse 14, which reads like this. You, that's Yahweh, you cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate that he may bring forth food from the earth, language taken from Genesis 3. And that verse, and it's celebrating the fecundity of the ground. There's no hint there that food production has now been ruined due to God's judgment in Eden. Indeed, even our text here in Genesis 3 kind of faintly suggests, doesn't it, the potential there's still going to be within this cursed setting to develop what the ground yields and produce more sophisticated foods from it. There's that reference to bread in verse 19. And so I hope you can see where I'm coming from then, when I say we mustn't overestimate the severity of the judgment. Yes, God does something here to childbearing, something serious, something which even with all our medical advances in 2025 is still very much felt. There are those shrieks and groans reverberating around maternity wards everywhere. But God doesn't destroy childbearing. In 2025, it still happens. And still, it brings to people a joy that is virtually incomparable. And yes, God also does something here to food production. Something serious, something which even with all our technological advances in 2025 is still very much felt. There are farmers up and down the land grappling day and night to irrigate their crops sufficiently this dry summer that we've had and salvage this year's harvest. But God doesn't destroy food production here. In 2025, it still happens. And still, the variety and deliciousness of the things that we eat and drink are an enormous source of pleasure to us. And all of this, then, it's just a further manifestation, is it not, of something that we've talked about already in connection with this chapter, namely God's amazing restraint, his slowness to anger, his long-suffering character, his sheer reluctance when it comes to punishing human beings. And if you're not a Christian believer this evening, I would urge you, please don't presume upon that reluctance, because it will run out. His reluctance to punish you, if you remain his enemy, that will run out. And you need, therefore, a saviour. You need Jesus Christ. Don't presume upon his reluctance to punish you. But if you are a Christian believer this evening, marvel at the sheer loveliness of your God. The way in which, even here in the Garden of Eden, where the crime committed is so outrageous and so indefensible, even there, he almost, I think we can reverently say, he almost can't bring himself to be solely angry and nothing else. Yes, he is angry, but there's grace present too, tempering and moderating the anger, so that as he punishes human beings with one hand, with the other, he limits and restricts and offsets the punishment. I'm imposing pain, Eve. Pain in the bearing of children. But look, here's a bit of joy to go with it. I'm imposing toil, Adam. Toil in the production of food. But hang on a sec. Here's some pleasure and some satisfaction to go with it. This God really is rich in mercy, you see. There is just an irrepressible impulse deep within the heart of God to give and to bless. An impulse that's so irrepressible, it kind of pops out and bursts through in the most unlikely moments. Even indeed when God is direct in judgment at the people who've just wrecked everything. Worship this God, believer. Worship this God to whom being severe and retributive does not come easily and naturally. And intuitively, we mustn't overestimate the severity of the judgment. But then secondly this evening, we mustn't underestimate the severity of the judgment. We mustn't underestimate it. Let's think a bit more about the judgment pronounced on Adam. And it properly begins then with that line in the middle of verse 17. Cursed is the ground because of you. And the next few lines flesh out that curse which God imposes on the ground. They flesh out that curse in terms of food production, as we've already been saying this evening. The way in which the ground from now on, because it's cursed, is only going to yield its crops at a price. That price being toil and pain and effort and hard work. But you know, exhausting food production is not the only implication of the ground being cursed. And perhaps, as I say that, you're thinking, ah, yes, Dan, we know that. We know that a whole load of other stuff not mentioned here in this text also flows from the curse which God imposed on the ground. Stuff like earthquakes and volcanoes and avalanches and sinkholes and all the rest of it. We know all of that. But actually, what I particularly have in mind is an implication of the ground being cursed that is mentioned here in our text. And it's this: our bodies dying. Our bodies dying. And you might be thinking, well, our bodies dying, that's got nothing to do with the ground being cursed. Well, actually, I think it does. Look at verse 19. And God says there, by the sweat of your face you shall eat bread till you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. And I think we're meant to link that then to the fact that God has just two verses earlier said, cursed is the ground. And now he's saying you're going to return to the ground. And we're meant to understand then that this is how diseased and disordered and dysfunctional the ground in its cursed state has now become. In the end, it devours our bodies. It devours our bodies. As you die and your body decomposes and the dust of which it's made just joins all the trillions of other dust particles in the ground and is indistinguishable now from them. It's as if the ground has claimed you, it's taken you, it's eaten you up. That's the gory picture that's being painted here. The ground, blighted now with this divine curse, it isn't just a bit mischievous, throwing up thorns and thistles for us when we're trying to grow our carrots and potatoes. No, the ground is perverse now. It's warped now. It's hungry for our bodies now. And eventually it gets them. It gets our dust. It gets your dust. It gets my dust. It gets the dust of all human beings. This is why Paul, you see, in Romans chapter 8, that passage that we read a few minutes ago, this is why he doesn't use the language of curse there, does he? Even though he's clearly talking about what's going on here in our passage in Genesis 3. And he could so easily have used the language of curse in verse 20 of Romans 8. The creation was subjected to the curse. He could have written that, but he doesn't. He uses different language. He says there the creation was subjected to futility or frustration. Or even, I think you could just about translate that Greek word, absurdity. The creation was subjected to absurdity this day. There's just something so futile and absurd about the ground that is meant to provide for man, to provide crops in order to sustain man's bodies, instead consuming men's bodies. And I want us then to feel this evening something of the horror of that absurdity. Do you remember what I said? You probably don't, it was quite some time ago now, when I was talking about man being made of dust in the first place. This was in connection with chapter 2, verse 7, where we read, "Then the Lord God formed the man of dust from the ground." And I said that evening that dust is a pretty lame material for God to use. It's a pretty lame material. Mundane was the actual word that I used that night. But I said that it's not because God was having an off day when he created man that he used this very lame, mundane material. Rather, this was the situation. God created man in a provisional kind of way, with a view to a later upgrade. You see, man would complete his task of subduing the earth, and man would successfully keep God's command and refrain eating from the prohibited tree. And that would all trigger this grand upgrade, whereby man's frail, dust-composed body would be superseded by a vastly more glorious one. But now, of course, that whole arrangement is in tatters. Adam has failed to keep God's command, and he ain't going to subdue the earth. And what verse 19 here is showing us is that the consequence then of Adam messing up is not simply that there's no upgrade now for our bodies. It's worse than that. The consequence is there's now a downgrade in store for our bodies, a very, very terrible downgrade. It's not simply that this dust is not now going to be flooded one day with glory, as the plan was. No, this dust is going to go the other way. And it's going to come apart. And it's going to unravel. So that what were once arms and legs and torsos will become just flakes in the ground. This is horrendous. This is truly horrendous what we're talking about here. And my heading is, then, we mustn't underestimate the severity of the judgment. Because, you know, that's what our society does, isn't it? Oh, it's just a natural thing. It's just a natural thing that our arms and legs and torsos end up flakes of dust in the ground. It's just a cycle. That's all it is. Nothing to worry about. Nothing to get stewed up about. In fact, let's even change the law of our land so that very ill people can take an injection and hasten their bodies becoming dust. Because it's no big deal, your body becoming dust. It's okay. Don't worry about it. Enjoy the time that you've got when your body hasn't unraveled and become flakes of dust in the ground. But when that happens, don't worry about it. But of course, that may be the talk, but deep down, every human being knows that this is a big deal. Deep down, every human being knows that it's a monstrous thing. It's a monstrous thing that bodies once warm and energetic and beautiful, bodies that once ran and climbed and swam and cuddled and made love, that those bodies should become wind-strewn particles of dust. That's a monstrous thing. You remember how Hamlet was so appalled by it? In Shakespeare's play, in Act 5, Scene 1, he's in a graveyard accompanied by his friend Horatio. And as he's in that graveyard, it prompts him pondering the way in which this is what happens to human beings, and even the greatest human beings. And his mind goes to Alexander the Great. And this is what he says. He says, Alexander died. Alexander was buried. Alexander returneth to dust. The dust is earth. Of earth we make loam, clay in other words. And why of that loam whereto he was converted might they not stop a beer barrel? You see what he's saying there? He's saying that the dust which was once the body of Alexander the Great, it might end up being used as the seal to stop a beer barrel from leaking. He then goes on to talk about Caesar and the way in which this dust which once kept the world in awe, he says, might now stop the wind getting through the wall of a house. And Horatio is a very practical kind of guy, and he rebukes Hamlet for thinking these dark philosophical thoughts. But Hamlet's right to do so. Our society today is full of Horatios in denial of the situation. But the situation truly is grim. The dissolution of the human body into shapeless, unrecognizable, inanimate dust, that should never be accepted as normal and tolerable and just part of the cycle of things. This is a huge sanction that God is imposing here. A huge sanction. We mustn't underestimate the severity of the judgment. Now, you might be thinking, well, this is becoming rather a depressing sermon, Dan. you should have arranged your 2 points the other way round. And then we could have finished on the happier note that even in a world where, yes, our bodies do end up flakes of dust, there is at least the joy of children being born and the joy of eating bread that we've produced from the ground. And the situation, therefore, is not entirely gloomy. There are those blessings in the world, at least, those blessings to which we, in theological language, often give the label common grace. But I've arranged the sermon this way round, because actually I want to end now this evening on a brighter note than common grace. I mean, common grace is great, but given the awful solemnity of those words, you are dust, and to dust you shall return, common grace is extremely limited, isn't it? In what it can do to alleviate the awfulness of that. It's only the very slenderest silver lining. But I want us to think, as we finish, once again about verse 16. And remember I said then that verse, yes, it warns of painful childbearing now, but it also affirms that marriage and sex and childbearing are going to continue. And we said that's a very welcome thing. But now I want to say this. The real reason that the continuation of marriage and sex and childbirth is a welcome thing is not that those things bring joy and greatly enrich human existence. That's true. And Psalm 127 that we looked at on Wednesday evening, that's kind of pointing that out, that it's a beautiful thing, that children are born into the world and it does greatly enrich our existence, etc., etc. But the real reason that the continuation of those things is welcome is something else. The real reason has to do with where verse 16 is positioned. Do you remember that verse 16 is positioned, obviously, after verse 15. And we looked at verse 15 last week. And what is verse 15? Verse 15 is the promise of a seed, an offspring, a descendant of Eve, who is going to defeat Satan. And you see, that promise depends, doesn't it? It depends entirely on people carrying on getting married, people carrying on procreating, children being born generation after generation after generation after generation. If that doesn't happen, then there's going to be no seed of the woman who will crush the head of the serpent. And so the really great thing about verse 16 is that it means verse 15 can indeed come about. And there can be generation following generation following generation following generation. And Jesus can come into the world. That's the really great thing about verse 16. Yes, it's promising joy whenever a child is born, and that's great. But the really great thing about it is it means the promise of verse 15 can be fulfilled. And it was fulfilled. And Jesus did come into the world. And over the centuries between Genesis 3 and Caesar's census, in all those centuries, there were just all these obscure men and women, most of whose names we don't know, just getting married, having children. And one generation would follow another and another and another, and links were added to this chain, and longer the chain became, until eventually Jesus was born of Mary. And Jesus lived. He lived those 30 quiet years in Nazareth. And he lived those 3 public years, traveling around Judea and Galilee. And then there came Good Friday, when Jesus was to be executed, and just before he was nailed to that cross, he was mocked by a squadron of soldiers. And what did those mocking soldiers do? They ripped a branch from the hedgerow that had thorns in it. And they turned that into a crown and they put that on Jesus' head. He had this crown of thorns. Thorns, the very symbol of the curse in Genesis chapter 3, indicating that here was the king who was going to absorb the curse upon himself in order to break the curse and finish the curse and lift the curse and dismantle the curse. And a few hours later, Jesus died. He went the way that God says in Genesis 3, all men are going to go. But in Jesus' case, his body did not decompose. It didn't have time to decompose because just a few hours later, Jesus rose. He rose, showing that he had indeed undone the curse of the Garden of Eden. A second Adam walked the earth, we sang, whose blameless life would break the curse. Or as Graham Kendrick has it in one of his songs that isn't in our book, when the purest and best took the force of the curse, death's victory armada juddered into reverse. He broke the curse. He broke the curse. What wonderful news tonight. There is a king who has come and has broken the curse. And did you see in our other reading tonight, in Romans chapter 8, did you see how Paul does something interesting there? Paul is clearly reflecting in Romans 8 on Genesis 3. Clearly he is. He's talking about what happened there, and as we said earlier, God subjecting the creation to absurdity. And he mentions the pains of childbirth in Romans 8. But he mentions the pains of childbirth in an unexpected way. Because he talks in verse 22 of the creation. The creation groaning in the pains of childbirth. Now, in Genesis 3, it's women who are going to experience the pains of childbirth. The creation, there's no hint that it's going to experience the pains of childbirth. The creation is just this cursed thing. The ground is this cursed thing which is going to devour our bodies, as we've been saying this evening. Just depressingly consume our bodies. But you see, because Jesus, the curse breaker, has come, Paul now transfers that promising idea of the pains of childbirth. He transfers that from the woman in Genesis 3 to the creation. And he says the creation is groaning now in the pains of childbirth. It's going to give birth to a new creation. Because the Jesus who has come once to break the curse is going to come again. And at his second coming, the creation is going to give birth to a brand new pristine creation where there'll be no more thorns and thistles, no more curse, no more devouring of our bodies then. Creation and the ground and our bodies will be in perfect harmony. What a thing that is. And I'm saying then, common grace is great. It's great that in a cursed world, God still enables us to enjoy our food and enjoy babies being born. But there's something way, way better than common grace. There's the gospel of Jesus Christ, the seed of the woman, who came, crushed the head of Satan, broke the curse, and is going to come again and bring in a new world. There's a new world going to be born out of the ashes of this one. What a gospel. Don't you want that tonight? Don't you want that? In a world where death is so pervasive, so ubiquitous, so universal, where the ground is swallowing up everyone's body eventually, there's no other hope. There's nothing else out there that can provide a satisfactory answer. But the gospel of Jesus Christ can. There's this one, and you can go to him, and he can deal even with the greatest, biggest, most enormous problems that the cosmos is facing. Go tonight to Jesus Christ, the curse breaker. Amen. Well, let's close singing number 300.